This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. This is Earth Matters.
Oil accounts for about 41% of all CO2 emissions, oil 34%, and natural gas
25%.
I think we should do karaoke after this.
I'm Gina Camilla, and on the segment this week, more stories from the recent COP23 climate negotiations in Bonn, Germany. Leading up to the COP, the buzz surrounding President Donald Trump's announcement to pull the US out of the Paris Agreement would not die down. But the US did send an official delegation, as they always would, although this time the Trump administration went a step further and brought along with them a panel to promote coal. What you just heard was the protest that disrupted the said panel. The crowd turned their backs to the speakers and sang a rendition of Proud to Be an American before staging a massive walkout that left the room nearly empty just after White House Energy Advisor George David Banks began the introductions. If the US is not invested in climate action, then why are they participating in a climate conference? And when everyone else is switching focus from fossil fuels to clean energy, why the tone-deaf promotion of coal?
It's an insult. The fact that they think that this is normal, okay, sane, they're clearly taking this whole process and insulting it, and insulting the people in the US and in the world who are very clearly demanding climate action. So for them to think that it's normal and okay for them to do something like this is again showcasing how much they are out of touch with any level of reality or sanity.
That's Hoda Baraka of 350.org, an international organization that builds global grassroots movements for climate solutions. And she's not alone with her criticism over the event. Michael Bloomberg, the former mayor of New York, posted on Twitter that promoting coal at a climate summit is like promoting tobacco at a cancer summit. So we decided to speak to lead climate negotiator from the Obama administration to hear his take first on the Paris Agreement withdrawal and then on the coal lobbying. Paul Bodner, who is also the managing director at the Rocky Mountain Institute, believes that Donald Trump cannot halt U.S. climate progress. The U.S. formally notified the UN in August of its intention to withdraw from the agreement. But because of the agreement's legality, the earliest withdrawal can only take place in November 2020, when Trump seeks re-election.
Good news is we absolutely cannot halt. The direction we are traveling is set. And you see that in U.S. emissions, which are declining. You see that in the fact that coal is simply uneconomic. You know, we're not talking in the U.S. anymore about subsidizing renewable energy. We're talking about subsidizing coal, or whether we should. So coal plants are dying out in the U.S. Half of the U.S. coal fleet has been retired or announced to be retired in the last 7 years. It's hundreds of plants. So the market in the U.S. economy, the market will set the direction. Clean energy is cheaper, period.
Sure, but it's not all good news.
What the Trump administration has the ability to do is to slow the pace of progress. And the pace matters because we don't have time to wait. You know, the longer we go with the fossil fuel economy, the worse climate change will be. So the direction is set, the pace is not set, and when the federal government can do all sorts of things to slow down the pace, reduce its ambition on vehicle fuel efficiency standards. It can implement tariffs on solar panels. It can do all sorts of things. But, you know, think about the following fact. There are 50,000 coal miners in the U.S. There are 250,000 solar panel installers. Not even counting wind or energy efficiency or all, there are more than 2 million people whose jobs are in the clean energy market. So our job at this COP is not necessarily to make earth-changing decisions. It's just not that COP, you know, in a sequence. It's not that there is a lot due, that you have to get it done or the world comes to an end. I don't think there's going to be all-night marathons, as there sometimes are at a COP. So it's not necessarily about making decisions that are important. It's about keeping the global community together in the right direction. And I think the global consensus on climate change has been tested with Donald Trump, and it has passed the test. So, yes, everybody's unhappy with what's happening in Washington, but it has not derailed the Paris Agreement. I was very impressed with what happened in the G20 earlier this year, where Saudi Arabia and the other countries in the G20 said, you know, we're gonna keep doing this. You can, you know, we're sad to see you go, America, but we're going to press ahead. And that was, you know, the ultimate stress test of the Paris Agreement's strength. So your government's job is to help keep everybody together in the system and moving forward.
It's easy for a big country to say, but what could smaller economies really do? What could Fiji, for example, which had the presidency of the COP, do?
I always have a lot of sympathy for COP presidencies. They have a very, very hard job to do. And it's complicated, it's arcane, it's irrational. The fact that you need to have consensus on everything is what drives a lot of the dysfunction, because it's always easier to disrupt a process than it is to build consensus in a process. So I think Fiji brings a great deal of moral authority to this task. So I think having calm, having the moral authority, being well organized is what's key, and being inclusive and hearing different people's perspectives. There are lots of the 197 countries here are divided into lots of groups, interest groups, SIDS, LDCs, the Africa group, the Asia group. Some of these are over the vulnerable, landlocked, mountainous states group, the umbrella group, the EU. So each group has an agenda. Any country has the power to block. So the way that the key to climate diplomacy is dialogue and making each group feel that their concerns are heard, and finding a way to give something to everybody and assemble it in a package. You don't have to be a big country. You don't have to be a powerful country. Fiji brings something that probably no country has ever had, which is it is on the front lines of climate change with existential risk at stake. And that compensates for size or GDP or population.
Well, what about financing? The parties to the convention had agreed that developed country parties are to provide financial resources to assist developing country parties in implementing the Paris Agreement. The US spent $2.6 billion in 2015 alone to support developing countries in climate mitigation and adaptation.
If you look at the official progress reports that have been issued, the progress is good. I think we'll get there. And I don't really think the US decision affects anything except the contributions to the GCF, the Green Climate Fund. But as regards the Green Climate Fund, which I negotiated back in the day, I guess I shouldn't be proud of that anymore. They don't have, let's put it this way, they don't have a shortage of money. They have a shortage of execution. So I wouldn't be surprised if they have $8 billion sitting in their bank account right now, or more. I'd be happy if they spent that money before Donald Trump leaves office. The fact that there's the U.S. in the first 2 years, that we put in $1 billion out of our $3 billion, we have $2 billion left. I'm not even sure they're going to need that money until we've said goodbye to Donald Trump. But we'll see. We'll see.
That's Paul Botner of the Rocky Mountain Institute. Up next.
This vision of a coal-fired economy, like, so, are we going to make the typewriter great again?
More on the American delegation at COP23 and the introduction of America's Pledge, led by the governors of the states, after this. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
Keep it in the ground, climate justice now. Keep it in the ground, climate justice now. Keep it in the ground.
I'm Arnold Schwarzenegger, and I'm here at COP23. We're talking about a lot of different issues, like, for instance, how many people die every year because of pollution? 9 million people, 25,000 every day. So this is a very serious problem. So we want all of you to join our crusade. Let's do it together, and then we can be successful.
Welcome back. It's Earth Matters. I'm Tina Camellia. Earlier, we heard from Paul Botner, the lead climate negotiator from the Obama administration, about why he thinks that Donald Trump cannot halt U.S. climate progress. We're continuing the conversation on Trump's coal push. At COP23, there were two American delegations. The official one that also did the side event on promoting fossil fuel.
I think the official delegation is keeping its head down, focused on the technical talks. Actually, generally speaking, the delegation's focused on negotiations. Actually, their positions on transparency and other issues are not necessarily radically different. Then the U.S. does not have a pavilion for the first time in a long time. And they're doing, to my knowledge, one event that is about fossil fuels. So, yes, it does make your head explode to think that you should come to a COP and do a side event on the role of fossil fuels in curing climate change.
But the panel did make this point.
We have received a lot of questions about this event. It sparked some controversy. Some people have called it provocative. You know, I think we would disagree. You know, let me explain. I think that this panel is only controversial if we choose to bury our heads in the sand and ignore the realities of the global energy system. If we are unwilling to have an honest, objective discussion about the need to balance effectively climate mitigation, economic development, and energy security objectives. The IEA projects a 30% growth in global energy demand by 2040. And that, by the way, includes roughly 500 million people who are still going to be without access to electricity. There are 1,600 coal plants being built or planned in 62 countries as of today. In Southeast Asia, for example, coal share of power generation is expected to increase from 32% in 2014 to about 50% in 2040. Global natural gas demand will increase 50% through 2040. So without a question, fossil fuels will continue to be used, and we would argue that it's in the global interest to make sure that when fossil fuels are used, that it's as clean and efficient as possible. In late September, ASEAN energy ministers called to continue public financing and support for new coal-fired power plants and to promote policies for clean coal technologies, including high-efficiency coal plants. In that same meeting, ASEAN ministers also recognized the important role that natural gas plays in tackling climate change, enhancing energy security, and driving sustainable economic growth.
Malaysia is one of those Southeast Asian countries that rely heavily on fossil fuel. More than 60% of energy production is gas, and more than 20% is coal.
This vision of a coal-fired economy, like, so, are we going to make the typewriter great again? It's too late for that. You have to help those people make a transition who work in coal, and have to look to the future, and that's what's going to happen.
And then there's the alternative U.S. delegation at the COP.
This coalition of U.S. states and cities and businesses that set up the U.S. pavilion. And we wrote this report, but so here are all the states and cities and businesses that have declared their ongoing support for climate action and the Paris Agreement. What this shows is these alone are the third largest economy in the world. And they have real power to shape emissions, and they are here in force. The U.S. pavilion at this COP is 10 times larger than the one the federal government had last year. The signal is we're still here. This is why our slogan is we are still in the Paris Agreement. And yes, it's disappointing, but this is still pretty good. We can build on this in the next few years while we wait for change in Washington. So this is the message that we carry here.
America's pledge is co-chaired by Mike Bloomberg and California Governor Jerry Brown to reaffirm U.S. commitment to the Paris Agreement on climate change.
California is the most aggressive, the most far-reaching climate action state in the country, in the Western Hemisphere. By the way, is it enough? No. Do we have a lot of pollutants? Yes. Do we have 32 million cars driving 335 billion miles every year? Yes. Are we going to stop them today? No. Are we going to stop them in time? Yes, if the America's pledge is picked up by the rest of the country and the rest of the world, which it will. And that's why we're here. And if we can take some of that noise, bottle it into energy and commitment, we'll get the job done. America, we're here, we're in, and we're not going away.
Well, what brings me is the threat of climate change and what the state of California can do about it and what California can do about it in cooperation with other states, subnational jurisdictions like regions and provinces and cities throughout the whole world. So we're here in COP 23 to advance the cause and to, first of all, talk about what we're doing in California, which is we're doing really a very aggressive climate agenda. More than most, but not enough. And I'm here to say that, look, you can do a lot, but you still have to go further because the threat to humanity is evidenced by all the reports that are coming out. We have to accelerate our decarbonization process. So I come here to meet with others, to join in new alliances, to learn from others, and in that way raise awareness so that we can then increase action. Those are the steps. Increase awareness, take increased steps to get the job done. Well, what's going on in California? First of all, we have a very aggressive cap and trade system, which will give us about 20% of our reductions, where we're moving down the amount of pollutants that we permit in California, and it's through this emissions trading system. Secondly, we have a renewable standard for electricity. We're at 30%. Purely renewable. We'll get to 50% in another few years, and then we'll go for 100. Thirdly, we have a low carbon fuel standard, so that when you put gas in your car, at least 10% will have to be low carbon, and we define what that is. Now, right now it's 2 or 3%, but we're aiming to get to 10%, and that's a very aggressive goal. Oil companies find it very hard to get there. But that's the California trajectory. And then we have zero emission vehicle policies, and we're pushing those. California has 40% of the electric cars in the whole country, in all of America. So we're doing that. And then we have efficiency standards for our buildings and for appliances that are also very aggressive. So we're doing a lot. But having just said that, it's nowhere near enough given the dire threat that the world is facing.
Al Gore, the former vice president, also spoke at one of the many side events at the alternative U.S. delegation pavilion.
After the final no, there comes a yes. And on that yes, the future world depends. Every great social movement in the history of the world that has improved the prospects for humanity has met with an endless series of no's and resistance that at times seemed that we couldn't overcome it. The abolition of slavery, the women's suffrage and women's rights movement, the anti-apartheid movement, the civil rights movement in my country, the gay rights movement more recently. In every case, people came to feel that it might be impossible. But once the question at the heart of the movement was resolved into a binary choice between what's right and what's wrong, the outcome became foreordained. That is the point that we are at right now with the climate movement. And during these days here in Bonn, we have to provide more momentum to that movement. We have to do it. We can do it. And for those who doubt that we have the will to change, always remember that the will to change is itself a renewable resource.
They released a phase one report on U.S. climate action at the COP to show state, city and business-led climate actions in support for the Paris Agreement. If these non-federal actors were a country, their economy would be the third largest in the world, only behind the U.S. itself and China. According to Bloomberg, they're helping to deliver on the promise of the agreement that pledged to measure and report progress in reducing emissions with or without Washington. Their efforts, though, will be focused mainly on just that, rather than financing developing country parties to support climate mitigation and adaptation.
States and cities are not normally in the foreign aid business. They don't normally think about this question. That's what the federal government does. They can't, you know, they can do clean energy and transportation in their cities, but they're not normally thinking about how to finance developing countries. So it's going to take some time to see whether we can do that. Yeah, so this focuses on climate mitigation, but there are, and we had to put this together really quickly, as you can imagine, but there are some very interesting initiatives starting on that finance dimension. And on Saturday, we had, after Governor Brown and Bloomberg launched this, there was a whole separate panel with Al Gore and two U.S. governors talking about this. And one of the interesting experiments, for example, in Massachusetts, one of the states, is they're giving taxpayers an option to send the portion of their tax return to the Least Developed Countries Fund, the LDCF. So these kinds of initiatives are popping up, and you know, it would be nice to see a crowdsourcing, you know, Kickstarter campaign or whatever for climate financing.
The America's Pledge report is only in its first phase. It examines current and potential future opportunities for non-federal actors in the U.S. to meet the U.S. commitment under the Paris Agreement to reduce emissions by 26% to 28% below 2005 levels by 2025.
So phase two is going to focus on analyzing the overall emissions impact of all of this. Right? You see, this analysis is about basically it's a footprint analysis, saying how much of the U.S. economy or population or emissions is part of the coalition of the willing. Next year, we're going to look at how these different actions will influence total U.S. greenhouse gas emissions, which is what people are interested in at the end of the day. And there'll also be a lot of work on what these actors can do to continue to do more and more, and to help people create a roadmap. Say, if you're, and this is what my colleague Jacob is doing for cities. He's doing a handbook saying, if you are a mayor and you want to do climate action and you think this is all very complicated, here, do these 22 things. Go do them. They're not complicated. Just go do them. So we want to do more.
In September of 2018, we're inviting states, provinces, cities, leaders of companies and universities to come to San Francisco and to declare, to disclose what their emissions are and what they propose going forward. And this will be another step to get ready for the next conference of the parties, which will be in Poland. The world has a long way to go. California wants to play and is playing an important role. And our summit, which I hope people listening will want to attend so that we can I guess in the lingo of the UN, increase ambition. What increase ambition means is to decrease emissions of carbon-based pollutants faster. Much faster. So that's the goal here. Today, a warning to humanity, second warning, came out from over 7,000 of the world's scientists. This was a warning first made in 1992. It's now been updated. Very, very dire predictions. The world has to wake up. What we're doing here is nice, not enough. And I say that for myself and for everybody else. We have to find the political will to invent the technical solutions to get the job done.
But how confident is Paul Bodnar that the U.S. can completely phase out fossil fuel?
So there's two things you have to do. You have to change as much of your energy economy to electric as possible, right? Electrify vehicles, electrify heating, and many things. So you're not burning fossil fuels directly to make cars go or to heat up your house or whatever. So electrify as much as you can and make as much of the electric system renewable as you can. Those are the two things you have to do. And you may not get it down to 0.0, but you can get it down very far by doing those two things.
And so what's next? Bodnar believes that it is time to end the era of climate diplomacy.
Well, I think the way forward is to take a moment and acknowledge the fact that the entire world, including Syria, Nicaragua, you know, minus the part of the map that's not colored in, has decided to do this. I used to say in the White House that before Paris, that our goal should be to end the era of climate diplomacy, meaning the high politics of climate change, where everybody's arguing about it, that should be over. If you think back to the 1980s when the ozone hole, there was a time when ozone was a big political issue, and they negotiated a convention, the Montreal Protocol. Guess what? People still work on that. Diplomats go to meetings, engineers work on solutions, people work on it, but it's been taken out of the realm of politics. It's just something we do. And I think we're making this pivot into that world, right? Of course, we're here, climate diplomats running around, but it's not a question of yes or no. It's a question of how fast, how far, and we should feel good about it. Because I think, to me, the story of this year is not that the U.S. pulled out of the Paris Agreement or announced its intention to pull out. It's that the rest of the world closed ranks.
So which delegation spoke for America? Who represented the country's best interests? Well, it's a free country, and the Americans get to decide which side of history they want to be on.
Carbon is the basis of our whole civilization. Without the oil and the gas and the coal, we wouldn't be here today. We wouldn't have the civilization of 7 billion people. But now we have to get off that, and that requires imagination, political will, and most importantly, global cooperation. We have to realize the promise of the United Nations when it was founded in San Francisco. And that's countries of the world working for peace, working for the benefit of all people, instead of getting bogged down in the obscene military budgets, the nuclear arms race, and all the rest. So there's plenty to do, and climate change is a good framework in which to address all the other significant problems that the world is now facing.
You've been listening to Earth Matters. I'm Tina Camilla, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.